welcome to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, July 24th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, Four Dead at Makita Caves State Park, including three members of Cedar Falls family. Three Cedar Falls residents died Friday morning at Makita Caves State Park. The Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation identified the dead as Tyler Schmidt, 42, Sarah Schmidt, 42, and Luella Schmidt, 6. Their deaths are being investigated as homicides, according to a news release from the Iowa DCI. A fourth person was found deceased of an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound, authorities said. Cedar Falls Mayor Rob Green issued a statement late Friday on Facebook saying the family was camping at the state park. The Schmidt's 9-year-old son, Arlo, was also there. He survived the attack and is safe, said Green. Green identified the family as his neighbors and said Sarah Schmidt was a Cedar Falls Public Library employee. Like many of you just hearing the news, I'm devastated, he wrote in the Facebook post. I knew Sarah well, and she and her family were regular walkers here in the Satori Park neighborhood. He had spent some time working with her during the past week on a presentation. Details will be forthcoming about services and other memorials, and I will ensure the community knows about this, Green wrote. Please offer some extra grace to the Schmidt's many friends, neighbors, and co-workers as we try to process this horrible tragedy. The Cedar Falls Library was closed Saturday for the sake of the staff who loved and worked with Sarah, he added. By Saturday afternoon, more than $63,000 had flowed into a GoFundMe page created for Arlo. The page, which says it was organized by a cousin, Beth Shapiro, states, Arlo is a strong boy, surrounded by family and friends who are supporting him as best we can. The page says the fund will help Arlo now and help fund his future education. To find the page, go online to GoFundMe.com and then search for Arlo Schmidt. This is a subheader, looks like. It says, found at campsite. The Jackson County Sheriff's Office and DCI were called at about 6:23 a.m. for a report of a shooting at the park campground. Mike Kropfel, a special agent in charge with the DCI, said during a news conference late Friday morning. When officers arrived, they located three deceased bodies at a campsite, Kropfel said. As officers searched the campground, they learned one other camper was missing. He was later identified as 23-year-old Anthony Sherwin, and we had information that he was armed at the time, Kropfel said. Sherwin was found dead about 11 a.m. west of the park. He had an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound. Kropfel said during the course of the investigation, authorities learned that Sherwin was armed and that the course heightened our awareness. Iowa allows people with permits to carry firearms virtually anywhere in the state. Officials did not say if Sherwin had a permit and provided no information about the firearm that was used to kill the Schmidts. Investigators were still trying to figure out what relationship, if any, there was between the Schmidts, Sherwin, Kropfel said. Mitch Mortvedt, Assistant Director of the Department of Public Safety's Division of Criminal Investigation, told the Associated Press on Saturday that the motive for the attack was still unknown. We don't know what led up to this, what precipitated it, he said, adding that so far the investigation has not revealed any earlier interaction between the Schmidt family and him. Autopsies on Sherwin and the victims were scheduled to be performed over the weekend. Mortvedt said that and more information will likely be released based on those findings. The Des Moines Register reported that Sherwin came from La Vista, Nebraska. La Vista Police Chief Bob Lauston told the newspaper that Sherwin had lived in an apartment complex with his parents and that he had no history of criminal conduct. The park will be closed until further notice because of the investigation. Onto another subheader, it says, Crowded Park. Other people were in the park at the time, and at least some of them were evacuated. The campground was relatively full, Kropfel said, though he did not have the exact number of people who were in the park when the police arrived. Officers made contact with all the campers, tried to get as many out as they could, Krepfel said. There was believed to be no further threat to the public. One employee at Makeda Caves said that at about 8 a.m., she was given the option to go home after police arrived and the park was locked down in response to the report of a shooting. Parents with children attending nearby Camp Shalom were notified Friday morning that it was also locked down. We were just notified that there was an active shooter at Makeda Caves, according to a Friday morning message to campers and parents. Our top priority is camper safety, and we are following the protocols. Fridays are usually pickup days for campers at the Christian-focused camp. It's about a mile and a half away from the Makeda Caves, said Executive Assistant Beth Salak. But plans changed at 9:11 a.m. when local law enforcement sent a notification to the directors that there was an active shooter situation at the state park and told them to evacuate immediately. So Salak said staff shifted gears. We told the campers we're going to do a surprise visit to Little Bear Park and Makeda. They all cheered, and we loaded everyone into the bus. They had no idea there was an active shooter a mile and a half down the road. She complimented the staff for staying calm and quickly changing plans, as they trained to do in emergencies. Campers this week ranged in ages from second graders to seniors in high school. Nobody expects for this to happen. The Makeda Caves? Come on, Salak said. It's one of the safest places you could be. I take my kids there, I hike there with my friends. That doesn't mean you can't in the back of your mind be prepared. Another subheader, officials respond. State officials issued statements about Friday's incident. I'm horrified by the shooting this morning at Makeda Caves State Park and devastated by the loss of three innocent lives, Governor Kim Reynolds said. As we grieve this unimaginable tragedy, Kevin and I pray for the victims, whose family members, and the law enforcement officers who responded to the scene. We ask Iowans to do the same. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley said on Twitter that he was closely monitoring the situation in Makeda Caves State Park. Praying for the lives lost and their loved ones, I'm grateful for Iowa law enforcement who responded, plus camp staff, for ensuring safety of other campers. Violence can't be tolerated. Killing innocent people is sickening, Grassley tweeted. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst likewise wrote on Twitter, I am heartbroken to hear of the tragedy in Makeda Caves State Park. I am praying for the victims and their families. My staff and I are following the situation, thankful for all the responding law enforcement. Kyla Lyon, Iowa Department of Natural Resources Director, said that she and the DNR staff were also devastated by the incident. Our long-standing tradition of enjoying Iowa's natural wonders was shaken today, but the legacy for the millions of families that recreate at Iowa State Parks will continue, Lyon said. Now, let's move on to a different article. Let's go to, with strong polling, money advantages, Reynolds focuses criticism on Biden, National Democrats. A little more than 3 months out from Election Day, the early measurables suggest that Kim Reynolds, Iowa's Republican governor, is a heavy favorite to earn another four-year term as the state's chief executive. Reynolds has dominated the campaign's fundraising efforts, and early polling suggests that she is overwhelmingly the choice of voters. Four top national election forecasters all rate Iowa's gubernatorial race in their strongest category for a Reynolds win. Deidre DeGeer, the Des Moines businesswoman and the Democratic challenger, has lagged far behind Reynolds in fundraising and polling. DeGeer has been attempting to make up that difference on the ground by hosting public campaign events across the state. Withholding a comfortable lead in the polls while running for re-election in a state that has a low opinion of the Democratic President Joe Biden's job performance, Reynolds appears satisfied, at least early in the campaign, to focus her criticism on Biden and congressional Democrats rather than on her opponent, DeGeer. Reynolds frequently blasts Biden and Democrats in Congress in her media appearances. She rarely mentions DeGeer. With Governor Kim Reynolds having that lead, she doesn't necessarily have to talk about issues. The challenge for DeGere will be to bring the issues to the governor, said Donna Hoffman, a political science professor at the University of Northern Iowa. Certainly, Governor Kim Reynolds can try to nationalize this election because it's in her best interest to do that. Run against Joe Biden, run against Joe Biden's policy, tie DeGere to Joe Biden. Reynolds was chosen by national Republicans to deliver the party's response to Biden's State of the Union address in January. The Reynolds campaign declined to comment for this story. At a campaign event last week in Cedar Rapids, DeGere said that she is focused on reaching out to Iowans. I don't necessarily need the governor to engage me. We all know that I am the governor's opponent, not President Joe Biden, DeGere said. And it's clear to me more now than anything, especially as consistently that she has mentioned his name, that her perspective or focus is not on Iowa. Her focus is on something else, and we need leadership in the state to focus on us. Who needs my attention? Iowans. Iowans need my attention. Iowans need the attention of their governor. So if she says my name or not, it's not the end of the world. What's more important is that we connect with the voter, and that's what I'm focused on. DeGere said that she plans to travel to all 99 Iowa counties, a practice made by famous longtime Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, to reach voters in all corners of the state, and to continue to raise money for the campaign. And DeGere said the early poll results do not concern her. Over the past week, the Des Moines Register and Mediacom poll, considered by many to be the gold standard in Iowa politics, showed Reynolds with a 17-point lead, and a poll commissioned by the Iowans for Tax Relief Foundation showed Reynolds with a 15-point lead. Rick Stewart, the Libertarian Party candidate for governor, was at 5% in the Iowa poll. We knew that this was going to be a hard race, DeGere said, but where we are right now is actually really about digging deep and working our plans, and we'll see the fruits of our labor. Tim Hagel, a University of Iowa political science professor, said there is still time for DeGere to chip away at Reynolds' lead because many of the voters are not yet turned into the 2020 election campaigns, and because many voters have not yet become familiar enough with DeGere to form an opinion of her. Having said all that, yeah, a 17-point lead is pretty big, Hagel said. Hagel and UNI's Hoffman said Reynolds came into the campaign with at least two key foundational advantages. Iowans historically like to vote for their incumbents, regardless of political party, and Biden's low job approval numbers nationally and in Iowa could make it hard for Democratic candidates to win here, especially statewide. Most national polling aggregators show Biden's average approval rating in the 30s and disapproval ratings in the upper 50s. Even though technically he's not on the ballot, everybody knows that effectively a midterm election is a report card of how the president's doing in the first 2 years of the administration, Hagel said. And for the Biden administration, it's not looking too good. And so that's what allows Republicans to focus their attention perhaps on him and what's going on there, rather than necessarily your opponent. The general election will be November 8th, and Iowa early voting will start on October 19th. Now let's go on to the article. $3.5 million grant will allow Cedar Valley Nature Trail to become all paved surface. With the help of a $3.5 million Destination Iowa grant, the original 52-mile Cedar Valley Nature Trail is on track to soon become a completely paved surface. Governor Kim Reynolds' office announced Thursday the state funding from Iowa Economic Development Authority made possible through American Rescue Plan Act COVID-19 relief dollars will benefit users of the trail connecting the Waterloo, Cedar Falls, and Cedar Rapids metropolitan areas. The grant was part of a second round of funding from the $100 million pool dedicated to Destination Iowa, which, according to its website, provides funds to bolster the quality of life in Iowa and Iowa's communities and attract visitors and new residents to the state. The $3.5 million allows the Blackhawk County Conservation and Linn County Conservation agencies to address the remaining 16 miles of chip limestone surface and dirt. from just east of LaPorte City, south to Iowa Highway 150 in Urbana. Of the 16 miles, 9.44 miles is in Blackhawk County. The original 52-mile trail, which has been around since the 1980s, is split evenly in mileage between Blackhawk and Linn counties. In Blackhawk, it begins with the trailhead in Evansdale off U.S. Highway 20 near 6th Street and River Road. According to the news release, it passes through 5 counties and 11 cities in the region. This project will serve to complement the many recreational, cultural, social venues along its path, said Mike Hendrickson, executive director of the Blackhawk County Conservation, in a new release. The completion of this project will boost tourism in this region and the state of Iowa as a whole. Conservation's planning administrator, Cherry Northrup, says that the project is the final design stage and that the state funds pushed it over the top, guaranteeing the estimated $9 million project will be completed. "We're elated," Northrup said. "This is the final piece to fulfill what has been a goal since the 1980s, to make the trail more accessible for all user groups and age groups." She said the new hard portions will heavily benefit those who like to rollerblade, skateboard, and bike. The grant also means the final unpaved segment can be addressed all at once, not in small pieces, which had been the case the past several years. "Tens of thousands of people use the trail, but this section of the trail does not get used as much," Northrup said. She said officials have found the unpaved portion to be used at least 50% less than the hard surfaces. Northrup said no construction date has been set, but she is hopeful construction will begin by next summer. It is expected to take several months. The remaining project cost, which is 60% local matched needed for the grant, is being covered by the Linn County Water and Land Legacy Bonds, other ARPA funds, and gift donations. Additionally, the project includes needed bridge replacements, box culverts, and watershed controls to improve drainage and water quality along streams and creeks adjacent to the trail. "Two bridges will be replaced," said Northrup, "one over Mud Creek in Blackhawk County and the other over Bear Creek in Linn County." Now let's read the article in Uvalde, "Closeness Complicates Accountability for Shooting." After the massacre at Uvalde Robb Elementary School in May, Jesse Rizzo was worried about his old friend, Police Chief Pete Arredondo. Blame for the botched police response was being directed heavily at Arredondo when Rizzo texted him just days after the shooting, "Been thinking about you and of you and praying for you." 2 months later, with investigations and body camera video spotlighting the hesitant and haphazard response by police to the killing of 2 teachers and 19 students, Rizzo remains worried about Arredondo. He also wants him fired. Rizzo's complicated feelings towards his Uvalde high school classmate capture the type of mixed emotions that families of victims and many residents of this close-knit community are navigating as they channel their grief and fury into demands for change. "I care about Pete. I care that he's mentally okay. I don't want a human to start to lose it," said Rizzo, who is distantly related to a 9-year-old girl who was killed at Robb Elementary. "But I also want to hold people accountable who don't perform their jobs properly." The 50-year-old Arredondo, who, as head of the school's district's small police department, was one of the first officers on the scene, has taken much of the blame for not immediately storming the classroom and confronting the shooter. He has not responded to repeated requests for comment by the Associated Press. Last week, the Uvalde School Board abruptly scheduled a meeting to discuss firing Arredondo, only to cancel it days later. As officials weigh their options, residents are growing impatient with the unanswered calls to hold people accountable for the bewildering 77 minutes of inaction by nearly 400 police officers who responded to the school shooting. But the mere possibility of his firing after months of resistance from local officials stands as a demonstration of the victim's family's rising political clout. The strain over how to move forward is visible in the signs that have popped over the town. Uvalde United, Uvalde Must Stand Together. While those signs mean different things, depending on whom you ask, other signs are more pointed, prosecute Pete Arredondo. Family ties and political struggles go back generations in Uvalde, a community where nearly three-quarters of the residents are Hispanic. Locals had largely revered the police chief before the shooting. Uvalde leaders, many of whom are white, share church pews with their fiercest critics, and demanding accountability can mean calling for the job of your friend, neighbor, or employer. It's a town with a power structure and unwritten rules that make it hard for many people to speak out, said Michael Ortiz, a local college professor who moved to Uvalde 13 years ago, and said his tenure allows him to be vocal in a way that's not viable for many of the community's mostly working-class residents. Someone's boss might not like that, Ortiz said. They are afraid even to march. Since the shooting, the mostly Hispanic parents of the victims have struggled to make their demands heard by the city and school district. Local officials initially resisted releasing information and calls to fire officers, but things are shifting. In a sign of growing political activism, more than 300 people have registered to vote in Uvalde since the shooting, more than double the numbers in the same period during last midterm election season. And in July, over 100 protesters braved the 106-degree heat to call for stronger gun regulations, including raising the minimum age to buy an assault weapon, and for greater transparency from local and state authorities investigating the shooting. That was the largest local demonstration since 1970, when the school district's refusal to renew the contract of a popular Robb Elementary teacher prompted one of Texas's longest school walkouts over demands for equal education for Mexican-American residents. That teacher's son is Ronnie Garza, an Uvalde County Commissioner. Garza said the shooting has changed the community, uniting people in grief but dividing them on questions of accountability. We are all a desperate people right now. We are yelling here that way, we are yelling the other way, and for someone to listen to us, to come and help us, said Garza. Faced with the incomplete and contradictory accounts from local and state law enforcement, the families of those killed in Uvalde have begun to make people listen. After state lawmakers issued a damning report that found systemic failures and erroneous poor decision-making by both police and school officials, the Uvalde School Board held a special session to hear from parents. Superintendent Hal Harrell apologized for previously being too formal and not letting the victims' families say their piece. Trying to find the right time, the right place out of respect, I did not do well, said Harrell, who is white and spoke in an auditorium named for his father, who was also superintendent. For the next 3 hours, grieving parents and community members upbraided the board, saying that if it didn't hold people accountable, they would lose their jobs. Some told Harrell that he wasn't living up to his father's legacy, while others referenced the 1970 lockout and said that they hoped that he would do better, drawing applause. People called for the whole school police force to be fired and jeered at the state troopers standing on the room's edges. Rizzo, who was standing at that meeting, said that he cannot respect how the police chief or many other officers he knows handled their jobs that day. There are consequences to that, he said. I can't understand why he wouldn't just resign. But the long history between them tugs at Rizzo, too. In the text he sent to Arredondo days after the shooting, he said, please be strong and be patient. Arredondo responded, good to hear from you, bro. Thank you, and please keep praying for the babies. They haven't spoken since. Now let's move on to, in Cedar Rapids stop, DeGeer rallies Democrats to unseat Reynolds in tough race. Attempting to diminish the significance of poll numbers and fundraising that trails Republican Governor Kim Reynolds, Democratic challenger Deidre DeGeer told Linn County supporters Thursday that such figures do not capture the sentiment of Iowans. Campaign filings this week showed Reynolds has more than 10 times as much cash in her campaign coffers as DeGeer in her bid for a second full term, as a new Des Moines Register/MediaCom Iowa poll shows the Osceola Republican with a 17-point lead in the race. That poll gives us a barometer, but it does not tell us what people actually feel all over the state, DeGeer told about 75 attendees of a fundraiser at CSPS Hall in Cedar Rapids, which included candidates, elected officials, local activists, and faith leaders. What does that is our continued efforts and our approach to meet people where they are. The November race for governor is tough, she said, but Reynolds' approval ratings have fallen as people of all political stripes don't like the direction of this state. Most of recent Iowa poll found Reynolds' approval rating has risen in recent months. Overall, 52% of Iowans approve of the way she's handling her job, up from 49% in March. They see that there is a stronger Iowa in our future, and our current governor is just holding us back, DeGeer said of Republicans, Democrats, and independents alike. On a recent swing through western Iowa, DeGeer said Iowans were making due grapplings with their challenges. She said that showed her Iowans already have the vision and the solutions to move the state forward. We're not short of vision, folks, DeGeer said. We just need a governor that's willing to turn the lights on. Eric Van Lanker, DeGeer's running mate, said Iowans' concerns that DeGeer hears on the campaign trail are issues that Reynolds' administration is not addressing. How am I going to pay for these groceries? Can I afford the rent I'm paying now? Can I take my child to a doctor's appointment and afford it? DeGeer's solutions are from the heart, Iowa solutions, he said. She's spending time listening to the Iowans from every corner of the state to understand the common ground that Iowans share, Van Lanker said. If elected, Van Lanker told the Gazette their day one priority would be to fund public schools. DeGeer said that starts with early childhood education and continues through the community colleges and public universities, governed by the State Board of Regents. It impacts every aspect of what we're doing right now when we look at the challenges we have, with a shortage of skilled workers to fill empty jobs in Iowa, DeGeer said. Despite likely facing a Republican-led legislature if elected as Democratic governor, DeGeer said that she would reach across the aisle and work with people regardless of political affiliation. She said that she and Van Lanker, the Clinton County auditor, would focus on empowering local communities to ensure all of Iowa's 99 counties are strong. DeGeer said that there is a strong path to victory if, unlike 2018, independent voters, people of color, and the ages 18 to 24 voting bloc all cast ballots. To rally the reliably blue Linn County based around other Democratic candidates on the November ballot, Anne Brown, who co-hosted the fundraiser with Amara Andrews, highlighted officials in the room, including some who are seeking re-election. Brown also mentioned several candidates, including Elizabeth Wilson in the Iowa House District 73, a district we need to keep Democratic, and Chris Nall in Iowa House District 83 in rural Linn County, a potential pickup for those Democrats. DeGeer urged the people to raise money so the campaign can air ads on TV, and volunteers can make phones and knock on doors to spread her message. She asked if the attendees were willing to bring home her victory for Iowa, in honor of the people who fought in the past for the rights to vote, access quality education, and reproductive health care. We've seen their playbook, DeGeer said. We've seen their culture wars. We will no longer settle for their tenacious complacency, good people, because we know we're better. Let's quickly read the article, Mega Millions Jackpot, now at $790 million, nation's fourth largest prize. Lottery officials on Friday raised the Mega Millions grand prize to $790 million, giving players a shot at what would be the nation's fourth largest jackpot. The next drawing is on Tuesday. The jackpot has grown so large because there hasn't been a winner in 3 months. Those 27 consecutive drawings, without anyone matching all six numbers, has allowed the jackpot to gradually grow from its $20 million starting point in April. The highlighted pre-tax $790 million prize is for a winner who takes an annuity option paid out in 30 annual payments. Most players choose the cash option, which for Friday's drawing would be $464.4 million. Mega Millions is played in 45 states as well as Washington, D.C., and the U.S. Virgin Islands. This game is overseen by state lottery officials. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, July 24th on Iris, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Roberta Maxine Simmons. Roberta Maxine Simmons, 79, of Cedar Falls, passed away at Allen Memorial on July 16, 2022. She was born on June 20, 1943, daughter of Robert and Dorothy Grafenow. On June 1961, Roberta graduated from East High. She married Roger Simmons on October 1961. Roberta was a teacher in the Waterloo school system for many years. She enjoyed online shopping, fingernail polish, and loved her collection of purses, shoes, and pajamas. Left to cherish her memory are her sisters, Sharon Whiteman and Donna Brandhorst, and many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents and husband. Connie J. Henderson. Connie J. Henderson, 88, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, July 20, 2022, at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Family will greet friends and family from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m., with a rosary beginning at 3:30 p.m. on Friday, July 29, 2022, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, Iowa. A funeral mass will be at 9 a.m. on Saturday, July 30th, 2022, at St. Matthew Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids. Reverend Douglas Locke will officiate. Burial will follow at Greenwood Cemetery in Cedar Falls, Iowa. Connie was born on January 28th, 1934, in Woodbine, Iowa, the daughter of Leslie and Alice Reed McCain. She was a 1952 graduate of Guthrie Center High School. On February 5, 1955, Connie was united in marriage to James L. Henderson in Des Moines. She lived in Cedar Falls for over 40 years and partnered with her husband running Henderson Traffic Bureau until her retirement in 2004. Connie was a member of St. Matthew Catholic Church. She enjoyed quilting, making a quilt for every grandchild. Connie was an excellent cook. While living at the Cottage Grove place for the last 10 years, she made lots of new friends. She enjoyed traveling with them and going on many adventures. Connie loved her family and was their rock. She was always devoted to caring for them and taking care of her husband. Connie will be greatly missed by all who knew her and loved her. Connie is survived and lovingly remembered by her four children, James Henderson of Marion, Julie Craven of Minneapolis, Linda Gill of Aurora, Colorado, Teresa Henderson of Colorado Springs, six grandchildren, Allison Ratchford, Chloe Howe, Molly McGaffick, Margaret Thompson, Sean Craven, Georgia Henderson, and six great-grandchildren, Arden Ratchford, Mercer McGaffick, Anderson Ratchford, Celia McGaffick, Booker McGaffick, and Rosalie Thompson, and many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, Leslie and Alice McCann, husband James L. Henderson, son Charles Henderson, sister Ellen McCann Ray, and four brothers John, Joe, Dean, and Bill McCann. Memorials in Connie's memory may be directed to the charity of your donor of the donor's choice. Please share a memory of Connie at www.murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Robert F. Bob Coyle. Robert F. Bob Coyle, 65, of Cedar Falls, died at home on Saturday, July 16, 2022. He was born February 12, 1957, in Seattle, Washington, the son of R. Gerald and Marion Coyle. Bob grew up in Detroit, Michigan. He graduated from Grosse Pointe South High School in 1975 and earned his bachelor's in theater from Wayne State University. He married Greta Berghammer in 1989 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and they later divorced. Bob was involved in entertainment and hospitality industries, primarily as an executive chef and property manager. He hosted the cooking show At Home in the Kitchen with Bob Coyle on KWWL from 1996 to 1999. Bob started the Panther Paws Cafe in the UNI bookstore and was the director of operations at Tony La Pizzeria in Cedar Falls and Tony Trattoria in Waterloo. He regularly volunteered in the Cedar Valley, including at the Sturgis Falls Celebration, the Waterloo Center for the Arts, and the Hearst Center for the Arts. Bob is survived by his son, Hanley Coyle of Burlington, Washington, three brothers, Tom Coyle of Grosse Pointe Farms, Michigan, Pat Coyle of Chicago, Illinois, Jerry Coyle of Grosse Pointe, Michigan, and a sister, Mary Lou Coyle of Grosse Pointe, Michigan. He was preceded in death by his parents. Services will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, July 30th, 2022 at the Dahl Van Hove Schoof Funeral Home in Cedar Falls, with interment at a later date. Visitation will be from 3 to 6 p.m. Friday and 1 hour before service Saturday at the funeral home. Instead of flowers or plants, memorials may be directed to the family for future designation. Online condolences to www.dahlfuneralhome.com. Paul Michael Moore. Pastor Paul Michael Moore, 74, was found deceased in his home in Waterloo, Iowa, on July 1, 2022. He died of natural causes. Paul was born February 23, 1948, in Malcolm, Illinois, the son of Ruth and Linford Moore. He was preceded in death by his parents, a sister, Patricia Moore, and brother, Stephen Moore. He is survived by his sister, Cecilia Shepard, of Williams, Iowa, five nieces and nephews, 15 great-nieces and nephews, and six great-great-nieces and nephews, all of whom he loved dearly. A celebration of life will be held at 3 p.m. Saturday, July 30th, 2022, at the Conger Street Church of God, 1050 Conger Street, Waterloo, Iowa. Jean Marie Droud. Jean Marie Droud, 72, of Cedar Falls, died June 18th at Pinnacle Specialty Care. She was born on November 7th, 1949, at St. Francis Hospital in Waterloo, to John and Edna Droud. Jean learned from her dad at an early age to work and always give whomever you worked for a good day's work. She started babysitting at age 15, and then after graduating from Columbus High School in 1967, she went to work for Sears Roebuck, a company, and worked for the company for 31 years, mostly in management. She even ran the State of Iowa Catalog Department for Sears. After Sears, she worked for the Winnebago Boy Scouts of America in Waterloo for 15 years as the Executive Office Manager. She loved both of these jobs and gave it her all. She always wanted to be in business. Both of these jobs fulfilled her desire since she was unable to attend college. Jean was a member of the Blessed Sacrament since 2002. She was involved in the church as a Eucharistic minister, sacristan, assisted with funerals, and worked on a team to enter updates for the host communities of Blessed Sacrament. Her faith was important to her and certainly got her through many of her health issues in her lifetime. Jean loved to travel, especially to see her family. Having two brothers, John and Joe, in the service, she was able to visit Germany, Alaska, and Washington, D.C., among other places in the United States. She was able to see things that the average person didn't get to see, and she felt very privileged and proud of that. Her baby brother, James, worked for the railroad, so she was able to sit in an engine and even had a penny put on the railroad rail that he drove the engine over. Her sister, Joan, was a nurse and could be counted on by the family, especially Jean, to be by her side through all of her illnesses. Jean, as well as Joan, were privileged to help in the care of her parents when they were in nursing homes. Jean loved to play cards and was often called a dirty pepper player. Playing any kind of games or knock poker, she was right there, but make sure you bring money. Going to the movies and out for lunch or supper was a monthly event. She loved playing games on her iPad and for 40-some years watched her favorite soaps. Jean loved to laugh and tried to get others to laugh too. Don't ever forget to smile. Survived by three brothers, John F. Jr. of San Antonio, Texas, Joseph A. of Orange Park, Florida, James of Waterloo, one sister, Joan Breyer of Janesville, Wisconsin, three special godchildren, Joe Drow Jr., Sarah Jean Breyer, and Robert Greenlee the fourth, six nephews, Joe A. Drow Jr., Jeff A. Droud, John F. Droud III, Matt Droud, Philip Droud, Mike Droud, and two nieces, Julie Alsup and Sarah Breyer, and a special friend and classmate, Jan Bergman. Memorial Mass is at 11 a.m. on Monday, July 25th at the Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church with interment at Mount Olivet Cemetery. Visitation 1 hour prior to the services at the church. Haggerty Wachoff Garup Funeral Service on South Street is in charge of arrangements. Memorials may be directed to the Cedar Valley Hospice or Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church. Now let's move on to the sports section, starting with Bucks lose lead to Duluth in 7-6 loss. The Waterloo Bucks lost 7-6, and the Duluth Huskies, as their strong hitting wasn't enough to match the runs surrendered by their pitching. The previous day, Waterloo lost 11-9 after giving up 9 runs to the Huskies in the fourth inning and failing to make up the deficit. This left them hungry for payback, but they ultimately fell short. "I'm proud of the way those guys stepped up, though," said interim field manager Tyler Willis. "I mean, the guys competed well, and they gave us a chance. We're sitting in the ninth inning having a chance to win, so I don't know that I thought that in the second inning based on how we were doing. So credit to the guys for staying the course on that." The scoring started in the second with an RBI singled by Devin Madden. Iowa City West grad and Hawkeye pitcher Marcus Morgan had a rough go in his second start for the Bucks, giving up 2 more runs by walking batters with the bases loaded. However, Waterloo didn't have to wait long to get on board. Catcher Raphael Pelletier knocked in Ryan Grabosch with an RBI double in the bottom of the inning. Another double by Cameron Cromper put them within a run of a tied ballgame, but they ran out of steam while relief pitcher Dylan Warda saw 2 runs scorched by Duluth on a double by Devin Hurdle. Hawaii slugger Ty Walton answered with a lead-off home run over the left field fence. Then reliever Dylan Warda held the Huskies down for 2 innings. The Bucks caught up in the bottom of the fifth with a tying double by Carl Korper, who was then batted in with a go-ahead single courtesy by Grabosch. "I'm always trying to be on time with the fastball and work on that," Korper said. "I was trying to take the fastball to the left field, and he threw me a changeup down and in, and I let my hands go, and I pulled it, and it was good." In the sixth inning, Christian Campbell erased their lead with an RBI single for a tie, while Waterloo failed to score on loaded bases. Campbell returned in the eighth with another single to take the lead back, which they held on to until the end, but Willis was proud of their resolve. "With a lot of these games, I'm proud of the way these guys compete," Willis said. "Sometimes we get down early and it's easy to fold, but our at-bats and our approach throughout the whole game was very good." Now let's move on to NCAA charges Tennessee with 18 major violations under Pruitt. Tennessee hopes its exemplary cooperation with the NCAA helps the Volunteers avoid serious punishment from the 18 major rules violations as easily as they dodged paying former coach Jerry Pruitt's multi-million dollar buyout. The NCAA notified Tennessee on Friday that of the Level 1 violations, the NCAA is most serious for allegations of providing impermissible cash, gifts, and benefits worth around $60,000 to football recruits and their families under Pruitt. The notice of allegations say at least a dozen members of Pruitt staff were involved in more than 200 violations over the two-year period. Tennessee has until October 20th to respond, according to the letter it received from the association's enforcement staff. Pruitt and nine others were fired for a cause in January 2021 after Tennessee started an internal investigation following a tip on November 13, 2020, and found what the university chancellor called serious violations of NCAA rules. The firing negated Pruitt's $12.6 million buyout after he went 16-9 in three seasons. The chancellor, Don De Plowman, had said that Pruitt was responsible for overseeing the football program. Tennessee also fired two assistant and seven members of the recruiting and supporting staff. Pruitt, three of his assistants, and three other staffers could face show cause penalties, making it difficult for them to get another college job after a hearing is held with the NCAA's Division I Committee on Infractions. In every step of this process, we took quick and decisive action that exemplified the long-standing values of the NCAA reiterated in the membership's new constitution, Plowman said in a statement Friday. The university hired outside counsel to fully investigate allegations about the football program, acted promptly to terminate the employment of football coaches and staff members, and shared our conclusions with the NCAA enforcement staff. Pruitt told ESPN that he was still reading through the report and seeing a lot of information in the allegations for the first time. I'd rather not comment a whole lot, past that, other than to say I'm looking forward to telling my side of the story somewhere down the road, Pruitt said. The NCAA investigators opened a case in December of 2022 and became more involved within the 2 weeks before Pruitt was fired. The complaint notes how Tennessee handled its investigation, showed the standard for any institutional inquiries into potential violations. The NCAA noted that Tennessee's immediately mirror-image football staffers' cell phones leading to information that substantiated the alleged violations. Tennessee wrapped up its investigations last November and announced that it wouldn't self-impose a bowl ban to avoid penalizing current players and coaches. New athletic director Danny White, who replaced the retiring Philip Fulmer, hired Josh Heupel in the late January 2021. Plowman noted that the NCAA enforcement staff recognized the university's exemplary cooperation in the case. While we take the appropriate responsibility, last fall, the university announced that we will not self-impose penalties that harm innocent student-athletes, like postseason bans upon the actions of coaches and staff who are no longer part of the institution, Plowman said. Three Level 1 allegations involve impermissible visits during COVID-19 recruiting dead periods. On nine separate weekends from July to November 2020, about $12,100 in impermissible recruiting inductments and unofficial visit expenses were provided for six recruits and their families to come to the Knoxville area, according to the complaint. Among the allegations, on at least 31 occasions from January 2019 to March 2021, outside linebackers coach Shelton Felton, inside linebackers coach Brian Niedermeyer, and recruiting staff member Bethany Gunn and Pruitt's wife, Casey Pruitt, provided about $16,300 in impermissible benefits to an individual in the form of cash, parking to attend home football games, and entertainment expenses to host a recruit's mother. And on 25 occasions from January 2019 to March 2021, Casey Pruitt allegedly provided a total of $12,500 in cash benefits to an individual for monthly car payments. Pruitt's and two recruiting staffers provided or arranged for approximately $11,223 on at least 20 occasions between January 2019 and December 2020. That includes $2,443 reimbursed to the assistant director of recruiting using Cash App for the costs that covered furniture, household goods, or party decorations. The then head coach also provided approximately $6,000 in cash towards a down payment toward a new car during an unofficial visit. White said in a statement that receiving the notice of allegations was an expected requisite step in this process, a process of our university initiated proactively through decisive and transparent actions. This moves us one step closer to a final resolution. Until we get to that point, I am unable to discuss that case in any detail. As a university, we understand the need to take responsibility for what occurred, but we remain committed to protecting our current and future student-athletes. Now let's move on to Hy-Vee pumps millions into IndyCar extravaganza. The longtime premise in Iowa of If You Build It, He Will Come originates with the 1989 Field of Dreams movie. A twist on the slogan could be used this weekend at the Iowa Speedway, where sponsor Hy-Vee has taken an If You Promote It, They Will Come approach to the star-studded IndyCar doubleheader that is being billed as one of the most anticipated race events of the year. The grocery chain headquartered in West Des Moines has spent approximately $10 million to rejuvenate the 7/8-mile paved oval built in 2006 to recruit top musical acts to perform Saturday and Sunday and stage family-friendly events all over the Iowa Speedway facility. I think this is a big, big deal for the city, and I don't want to say it in a disparaging way, but if you look at a lot of these small towns in Iowa, these small towns are struggling, and they need a boost. Hy-Vee CEO Randy Edgar said. We feel like Hy-Vee should be investing in small-town Iowa right now. We should be helping them grow, finding some things that we can be proud of, and put together 3 or 4 days that will be great for the city. Joseph Newgarden extended the team Penske dominance at Iowa Speedway on Saturday, winning the first race of the weekend doubleheader for his fourth victory at the shortest track on the IndyCar schedule. Newgarden raced in his series-best fourth victory of the season and moved from fourth to second in the tight IndyCar championship fight. Indianapolis 500 winner Marcus Ericsson finished eighth and had his lead in the standings sliced to 15 points over Newgarden. Newgarden had been 44 points out of the championship lead going into the race on the 0.894-mile oval, and can make up even more ground when IndyCar completes its doubleheader Sunday. Team Penske drivers have won 6 of the last 7 races at Iowa. Pato Ward finished second for Aero McLaren SP. Hy-Vee opened Iowa Speedway for free to fans for Friday's practices and expects about 40,000 spectators a day for the Saturday and Sunday races. The grocer writes checks to sign Tim McGraw, Gwen Stefani, Blake Shelton, and Florida Georgia Line for pre- and post-race concerts. And there's plenty, and there's a competition among food trucks located across the property. It's the kind of push that could turn Iowa Speedway into a destination IndyCar race, the way its current street course stops in Petersburg, Long Beach, Nashville, Toronto, and next year Detroit are celebrated. Those weekends are part of IndyCar Race Part Street Festival and all-day family fun. The race is being promoted in Hy-Vee stores across Iowa with ample significance and life-size cutouts of IndyCar driver Jack Harvey, who is in his first season sponsored by Hy-Vee at Rahal Letterman Lanigan. The British driver hails from a small English town of nearly 4,000 miles away, and Hy-Vee has made Iowa Speedway feel like Harvey's home race. He said that he gets stopped all over Des Moines area, unfathomable to a Brit who has made his U.S. home in Northside, Indianapolis. I really hadn't spent too much time in Iowa before, and I live in Indy and I'm from the U.K., and this feels like a home race for me, Harvey said. The amount of people that stop us to wish us good luck or to say so on social media is just beyond anything I've ever experienced. You even walk into a Hy-Vee Fast and Fresh, and you still can't really escape us, which is hilarious in so many ways, just to see my face everywhere. NASCAR owns Iowa Speedway, but the track is leased to Penske Entertainment for the IndyCar races, and Penske has full rights to transform the facilities, with the massive red Hy-Vee banners and open-air temporary suites located in Turn 1. A little subheader here. Big opportunity. Harvey said that he's feeling the pressure to perform both Saturday and Sunday at Iowa, where Graham's Rahal third-place run in 2020 with the high B on the car helped launch the team relationship with good with the grocer. But the ovals had been a struggle for this year for RLL. Rahal, in the 14th, was the highest finisher in the Indianapolis 500 among the three Honda entries. Harvey, meanwhile, missed the race on the oval at Texas because of a concussion and is 20th in points. His best finishes this year are 13th, three different times on road and street courses. He is looking for a breakthrough on both Iowa races, and Rahal is coming off a fourth-place finish last week in Toronto. Globally as a team, we've been showing more pace, and you get the sense that the season is starting to turn for us, Harvey said. I wish it'd been better this year. Obviously, you want to have a good race because it's a home race, but with the way the season's gone at this point, you just want to get good results, so wherever you can get that positivity or that rejuvenation, I don't care where that comes from, I'll take it. Final little subheader, hot day. Drivers are working overtime to prep for the 2 days of racing in temperatures expected to be the hottest of the year. The forecast calls for 100-degree temps for a Saturday afternoon race, and many drivers have been vocal in their wish that the 250-lap event would instead be run at night under the lights. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, July 24th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.